You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. And this is the last one from New Zealand now. And it's a comic who has a bigger profile in the UK now than back home in New Zealand. This guy is an absolute powerhouse of improvisation and creating an atmosphere. And as we'll find out, he's a real gut comic. This is Jared Christmas. So, Jared, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I know. It's oddly formal, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's get away from the formal as soon as we can by talking about what you were talking about the other night, about how annoyed you are that you haven't been getting the numbers you've expected.
Yeah, but I think everyone gets annoyed by that sort of thing. You know,
they do, and I don't mean to start this interview with like, so, if anyone's not heard of Jared Christmas, he's a massive loser who doesn't get numbers.
No, I'm... First of all, to get out of the way, I'm well aware of where I am.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And as a comedian, you're wanting to build a career and all that sort of stuff. And my main goal is I want people to come and see me doing my show.
Sure.
So,
well, to be fair to you, to be fair to the listener, let's set up where you are before we go into this. Because to me, it's interesting because I know you as a successful comic.
Yeah.
So let's just paint that picture first then. So who are you? How's it going at the moment? Whereabouts
right.
are you?
Okay. So I think I'm in a bit of a state of flux.
Brilliant.
At the moment.
Great.
As in, I am a hugely passionate and love stand-up. And most of the extracurricular stuff I've done is because I like the sound of it. It sounds interesting. And it's, I know I'll enjoy it. But also, the flip side of that is I want to attract an audience to come and see me. And so, you know, because I love playing the clubs. Love doing a bash.
Don't get me wrong. Love the clubs.
No, yeah, I genuinely do. The clubs, the clubs have made me. Absolutely made me. But it's called a circuit for a reason. Do you know what I mean? It's a circuit. You can keep going round and round. And, you know, worst case scenario is that's what I do. And that's not a bad thing, is it?
Not.
You know, because I love it. But you do get frustrated. That, especially comparing, holy shit, do you know what I mean? You build up all this goodwill and warmth, and then you just hand it off to someone else.
Totally know where you're coming from.
And
yes.
So with solo shows, I would rather play to 30 people who have chosen to come and see me than, you know, be on a lineup of, you know, playing to 400 and they've come along and you just happen to be on. Do you know what I mean?
I totally get what you mean. I wonder if people listening to this might go, "Oh, come off it," but I know where you're coming from. It's not about the size of the audience.
Not anymore for me.
Sure.
Not anymore. Don't get me wrong. I would love 450 people to come along and just see me.
Of course,
I would love that. But it just I feel it's more rewarding to do an hour and a half. To people who have made the decision, we're gonna see this guy. We like this guy. There's something about him that we like, so we're gonna go and see him. And I've always sort of prided myself on being able to play any room and create an atmosphere. Sort of, you know, give me a room, a 300 seat venue with 25 people in there, And I'll do my fucking damnedest to create an atmosphere, because that's what I like doing. Do you know what I mean? I like people walking away going, that was great. There should have been more people, but that was great.
Yeah.
Whereas I think there's quite a defeatist mentality amongst a lot of comics who would be in a situation like that.
Yes.
And they'd take it out on the people who have shown up. That's not their fault.
Sure.
They've shown up.
Sure, sure.
To the people who haven't.
I know, man. And I tell you what, this week, all this week, I've been having very low numbers, and I'm talking, you know, 15.
Yeah, yeah.
In a 60 seater, you know. Yeah. And I know that over here, I don't have a profile. I've not done the gala. I've not done TV. You know, I'm not doing another show in town. I can direct people here.
Well, I've got a profile over here,
yeah,
mate.
Yeah, and, man. I just wanted to finish that thought. Yeah. I've been getting low numbers, but I understand why, and it's still hard. And I'm not taking it out on them.
No.
It's just still psychologically difficult to go, okay, I'm going to give it my all for 10 people.
It chips away at you.
It does.
It chips away at you, and there's only so much you can take of that. That's why people walk away from festivals like Edinburgh like defeated. Do you know what I mean? Because they could have a really great show, but if you're pumping it out to 10, 15 people... they can't give you back what you need. There's just physically not enough of them. And also, there's no escaping the fact that there's fuck all.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you can dress it up. You can put positive spins on it. You know, like, I've got a couple of tricks I do of sort of going, you know, like, if there's 20 people in there, you know, I'm like, oh, just let you know, 150 people applied to come along to the show tonight. Sure. And the venue rung me and said, are you happy with that? And I said, no way. Most of them are going to be dicks.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So let's vet them. Let's find the people who aren't dicks. And we got 20. Oh, it's a horrible statistic. But you guys are the ones. Do you know what I mean? And that tends to work. But sometimes it still doesn't work. Sure. They're still sitting there going, ugh, this is...
Yeah. And you are left inescapably with the idea that you can't... How do you get word of mouth going when there is only
20 mouths to...
20 ears, 40 ears.
Yeah.
Connected to 20 mouths to tell people.
I didn't get into comedy to do maths, mate. but it's what it is when it's small numbers, it's a harder effort from you, the comic. It's because you've got to tap into that well of positivity that just keeps getting chipped away.
It's like surfing, isn't it? If there's no tide, you've got to swim. You've got to thrash. Whereas what you want is to go, look at this wonderful wave that's coming in that I will skillfully...
And when you don't have that wave, that's when you say that weird shit in between bits. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I've been doing that all week.
You finish a bit and you should just move on. You should just move on to the next bit. But for some reason, we're so used to that little bit having a bit of a laugh.
There's a bit of a laugh trailing off that we use to go, add on to the next bit.
To mentally click onto the next bit. But when you don't have that, that's when you get comments like, that happened.
Is that your one?
That's all I've got on that.
Is that your fallback one? I had a conversation with Josh Whitaker about this, or with Kumar, Nish Kumar, about Josh. And about the fact that we were sort of isolating our fallback sentences.
Right.
Mine is, and I'm so embarrassed about this, mine is, it's ridiculous. it's a verbal tick. It doesn't mean anything. All it means is, I was expecting noise here, fill in the space with noise, and on to the next thought.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
My one usually is, so that's all I've got on that topic.
Yeah, I've heard you say that.
and I've kind of developed a thing of sort of just going, dealt with.
Yeah, sure.
That's months of the year dealt with.
Yeah.
But, you know, hopefully I don't have to say that, but when there's low numbers, that shit sort of tends to come out.
It affects your momentum, it affects your rhythm, and you, more than a lot of comics maybe, are very connected to the momentum and the rhythm of the show.
I need it.
You need it. You're
it.
It's funny, I was thinking about you this morning. You're an improviser.
Yeah.
Obviously, in terms of background, in terms of ability.
Yeah.
You're an incredible compere, but I think the last time we gigged together was maybe in Colston Hall in Bristol.
Right.
For Steve Lance. It was like the Comedy Box had moved.
Oh, yes.
Night. And I was really blown away to see and to remember, oh, my God, how many stories have you got? How many jokes have you got?
Yeah.
How many, you know, they're all within a sort of, like, the relationship is there. They're not stories in isolation. They're stories which froth up out of the relationship you've made with the crowd. That's what you do. You're a live guy.
Yeah, I am. And I play the room. And that's why...
I think that's a very quick way of saying everything I just tried to say. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
As in, I get frustrated when you have to do tryout, you know, like a TV company's like, oh, you know, we want to see your TV-friendly 10 minutes, and you're in a club, and you go on, and something happens in the room, and you're going... I'm like, oh, I need to be in this room and deal with that. Mm. I can't just be spouting out. And whenever I do that, the gig, I hate it. And I don't think the gigs go that well. Mm. Because I don't think I'm in the room. And that's hard to have that when you're doing stand-up on TV.
Sure.
Because if you're in the room, it isolates, I think it isolates the viewer a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically,
yeah, you can see why that rule has arisen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But some people get away with it. Like Stuart Lee's DVDs, he tends to get away with it. But that's because he's putting the cameras sort of... He's filming it in a different way. Yeah. But if you've got someone...
He's in charge of it, isn't he? He's doing it that way as a specific choice, as opposed to following someone else's in...
Yeah, someone else who's, you know, gone, nope, camera goes here, camera goes here, camera goes here, and we've got a roaming camera just to get people's reactions.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? You can't, you know... And then they go... Beforehand, you have to let them know who you're going to banter with. With someone, and then, just so we can capture that. And you're like, oh, well, I understand all of that, but that then makes it feel artificial.
Sure.
So, low numbers hurts.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why we started.
Yeah, no, it is. And you were saying that's because you do have profile here. So for people that don't know you, did you start in New Zealand and then work in Britain and get bigger in Britain?
What was
the journey? Let's track it back to the beginning and how you started.
But before we do that, I think, truthfully, I've got more of a profile in the UK.
In the UK, I'm sure you're right, yeah.
So I started in 98. I did my first gig, which was... A friend of mine booked an improv night in a venue in Christchurch, and she realised that, you know, she had to fill the whole night. And so she asked me to do stand-up. And I'd never done it before. She said, why don't you give it a go? And I was kind of like, well, I wouldn't even know what to do. And she said, well, look, it's in a month's time, so just watch as much stand-up as possible, and I guess just adapt their stuff. And I was like, oh, okay.
Who was this woman to you? What?
I went to a sort of theatre course with her.
I understand.
Her name was Anna, and she was more on the... producing side, as in she wanted to put shows on and stuff like that. So she was always putting something on.
Okay.
And I was doing a lot of improv with a group called the Court Jesters, and we were doing like late night Friday night shows in a theatre, and they were amazing. And that's where I got all my performance stuff from, like stuff that I still hold true to what I do.
We've had this conversation before, haven't we, about how you could have been a street performer.
Yeah,
I almost went that way. I've got a new rule now that I'm not going to refer to street performing on the show because they always give me shit about it.
Yeah,
but this
enough.
Is a specific thing we're talking about.
I almost went that way. Because in Christchurch they got the Buskers Festival.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I was just looking for outlets to perform. Yeah. That's what I was after. I wanted to be an actor, but what I was doing about that was thinking, I'll just walk down the street one day and someone will see me and go, hey, we need that guy in our movie. Sure. And that was the extent of... and then when I discovered improv and discovered stand-up, it was like, whoa, yeah. I'm like the writer, the performer, the director. This is everything. I'm my own body. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is what I like. So she put on this this improv night that I was doing the improv and she said about the stand-up. And... At the time, they had really awful American stand-up on late at night, like Ray's Chuckle Hut, you know, and everyone's in a suit jacket, you know, with shoulder pads.
Do you remember any names?
No, I don't remember any names.
I know
any
the sort names. Of thing.
You remember. It would be like Live at Jongleurs sort of thing.
Gotcha.
And like really bad stuff. And so the first set I ever did...
So you mean in the sense of it was like commercial comedy, comedy set, but like shot in the venue and for exactly that problem we're talking about. It doesn't transmit well.
And also looking back on it, I think that was the type of stuff that led towards the collapse of the American live stand-up circuit, because there was just so much of that sort of vanilla comedy.
What do you mean, like the audiences started to... There was almost a cliche of what stand-up is, that whole...
It was a total...
White guys drive like this, black guys drive like this, that thing. Everyone went, we know what that is now, we don't need to go and see it.
I don't remember anything that struck me as inventive. Do you know what I mean? And I was watching it, treating it like a project, like I... had to do it. Whereas I would have rather sat down and just watched Whose Line Is It Anyway.
Sure.
Or Eddie Murphy, Raw and Delirious.
Mm-hmm.
Continuously.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I first watched those, I didn't know they were stand-up. I just thought it was a like, oh, that's a really funny monologue.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? I didn't see it as... I knew the term stand-up, but I wasn't aware... Do you know, it was weird. Because New Zealand in the 90s, there really wasn't much going on. So certainly live-wise, I wasn't exposed to it. So where I got it all was improv and the Buskers Festival. And the Court Jesters, a big thing throughout that group was whenever you're on stage, happy but humble.
Mm-hmm.
Happy but humble. Mm-hmm. Don't go on there all arrogant and shit like that. No. And also... the theatre is your home,
mm-hmm.
and you've welcomed the audience in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so don't be a dick to them, mm-hmm. essentially. And if you ever get anyone up on stage, they're the hero. You make them the hero.
Yes.
You don't get them up to make you look good.
Yes.
You make them look good. So these are principles that I've that my whole comedy has been sort of built on, and that's I guess why I try and keep things positive on stage and whatever. So the first stand-up set that I ever did...
How did it go?
It went really well.
Did you write material? Or did
No,
went out and winged the whole thing.
I didn't wing it. Fuck no. I was scared shitless. Scared shitless. And I had been going on stage for years doing improv.
With no material. With no material.
But when it came to just being up there by myself... And I'd done improv games where you have to be on stage... by yourself, but there's still the knowledge that your mates are there if shit starts going south.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But with the stand-up, I knew... No, mate, it's just... So I did a...
It's funny, the amount of times most comics, or a lot of comics these days, bemoan the kind of, oh, God, everyone's doing it these days.
Yeah.
I'm frequently saying, oh, the cat's out of the bag now, everyone knows it's not that scary. It is still terrifying.
Yeah.
And I think it is still... Do you know what I mean? That even when you and I, both professionals of one sort or another, think back to that moment, it's terrifying, isn't it?
It really is. And, I mean, it's not terrifying now, but I still get nervous.
Of course.
And I think if I don't get nervous, I think I'll probably have to quit. Because then I think I would have lost something.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Because I don't care how good you are, it's a different audience every night. Mm-hmm. In stand-up, you can control a lot of things. Your material, your performance, what you're going to do. The one thing you can't control is the random elements in the audience. And that is where the nerves should... There should always be an element of you going, fuck, I don't know how this is going to go. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But then when you're on stage, you can't have that fear. Because I don't think anything creative ever comes out of a place of fear. Because you're too worried about surviving.
Yes.
And that's why... years ago, I stopped playing the Jonglers gigs. You know, they treated comics badly when they were massive.
Okay.
And there were a couple of instances where I got treated badly, and they used their sort of muscle. And I thought, as soon as I can play enough clubs that I don't need Jonglers, I'm out. Which, you know... Fine, there were other people making more of a stand, sort of going, I'm just not playing them. I could do with the money, but I'm not playing with them. And that's a better stand to take. But, you know, I had a wife, so, you know, we're building a future together. So I was kind of like, no, I want to get to a point. And then I'm not going to burn my bridges with them. You know, some of their gigs, when they had them, were fantastic clubs. And it was all down to the people running them, you know. They were great gigs, but... I just felt when I was doing some of those gigs, I just wanted to survive. I just wanted to get through my time. Whatever it took to get through my time.
So this is Jared. We've got more great stuff coming up from him, including his own three C's of comedy and that flux that Jared mentioned earlier on, where he is at the moment. Some really invigorating stuff on when he tried in the past to inject some heartfelt material into an Edinburgh show and how that went. And also we'll be covering fake mistakes and how to cheat when you're acting in a sitcom. All of that stuff coming up. Thank you, as ever, for your donations. It's comedianscomedian.com. If you'd like to donate and support the show, just pick a figure, click on the PayPal button there, and donate whatever you like. £1 a show seems fair to me, but equally, if you are finding this stuff useful to your work or what you want your work to be, or indeed your life, then I like that you're finding it useful. So whatever donation you think is appropriate would be very kind indeed. And a special mention here to Gary Jackets, who's the promoter of the brilliant Joker Comedy Club in Southend-on-Sea in Essex. James Acaster and I were doing some previews over the weekend in his wonderful club, and he told me, thanks to everyone that came to those, by the way, we were both really happy with the results. We're getting very excited now about Edinburgh. James's show is terrific. I'm very, very happy and pleased with where I'm at the moment. Gary told me he'd listened to 12 hours of this show in a row, which sounds like just so much talk from an Essex geezer, until I found out that he did that whilst running an ultra marathon, which is a thing I didn't even know about before. Apparently that's three marathons in a row, uphill, whilst on fire. Well done, Gary. Maybe if you're not able to donate at the minute and you'd like to help the show out by recommending it to a friend, then seeking out an ultramarathon runner and telling them about it might not be a bad idea. I do like the idea of accompanying someone during something quite so challenging. Maybe they could take a sip of something isotonic whenever I mention street shows. But if you're accustomed to listening to this show whilst slogging your guts out doing something noble, do email me info@comedianscomedian.com or tweet me @comcompod and let me know. Similarly, if you normally like to enjoy the show in a hot bath or whilst oiling your sweetbreads, I don't know, it'd be nice to find the least noble listening practices too. Would it be nice? Would it be terrible? Right, a few previews still to come, and I'm going to mention some non-London gigs as well. I'm going to be at Glastonbury Festival. I'm emceeing the cabaret tent at lunchtime on Friday, and I'm doing a set in the cabaret tent at 6 p.m. on Saturday, so come by and say hello if you're at Glasto. I'm also going to be at the Comedy Store Manchester this coming weekend, lovely lineup there, and at Manford's Comedy Club in Manchester on the 3rd of July, and Manford's again in Huddersfield on the 5th of July. Those are my first gigs for Jason Manford's very exciting new business venture that we didn't actually know about when I interviewed him last summer. So that's all new, looking forward to those. The 5th of July at 4 p.m, there's an afternoon gig. I will be at Adams Grammar School in Newport in Shropshire doing a preview of my Edinburgh show Extra Life. And on the 6th, I'll be at ARG Festival back in London, argcomfest.com for all information on that. Loads of previews going on there. And do feel free to do the maths on that weekend's travel from the 3rd to the 6th. And if you're not a comic, why not breathe a sigh of relief? 10th of July, I'm in Narberth at the Comedy Club there. And if you missed the Southend gig at the weekend just gone, I'm previewing at Lily La Scala's, let's say, conservatoire on the 22nd of July in Lee-on-Sea. That's what I'm doing. Plus, of course, interviewing Arma Rahman, who's at Soho this coming week. Don't miss that. And in a fortnight, I'm bloody well interviewing Andy Zaltzman. Well done to those of you who guessed on the Facebook page. He is in the top five or so comics I get asked to interview by you lot. The other four, of course, are Kitson. So that'll be nice. Questions for Andy to me at ComComPod or on the email info@comedianscomedian.com. And just before we go back to Jared, something obviously horrible happened this week. Rick Mayall passed away, and I've never cried at the death of a celebrity before. I remember Adam Bloom on this show talking about how when Ad Rock died from the Beastie Boys, he actually felt far more connected to him, to someone he'd never met, than he expected to. I was really gutted to hear about Rick Mayall's death. I've never met him. And I'd never been lucky enough to work with him, but I actually found myself welling up because he was such a fundamental part of what I understand comedy to be. I've been in two double acts in my life, The Unknown Stuntmen on the Street and Kiosk of Champions, a sketch show with Richard Sandling. And both of those double acts were very much informed by the work that Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson did. Getting a cassette copy of a pirate copy of Bad News when I was about 12 at school was the comic strips heavy metal band project. It was one of the funniest things I'd ever heard, and I just wanted to say, actually, it's very encouraging when people die and Facebook goes mental over the deaths of people. I felt very proud to be part of a community of my friends on Facebook, lots of comedians obviously and comedy fans, where the ratio of people paying tribute to someone they thought was brilliant and really respected even if they hadn't known him, the ratio of those posts to, God, why is everyone banging on about Rick Mayall posts, was fantastically high. It was like 1,000 to 1. So far more people caring and saying nice things about someone they really loved and respected than whiny twats banging on about, why has everyone got on that? It's so insincere. That made me very happy. And Rick Mayall's work made me very happy. So I never met him or worked with him, but I hope he is sticking his dick in God's eye somewhere. That's all I wanted to say about that. Now, let's get back to Mr. Jared Christmas.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
For someone that hasn't been to a big kind of commercial weekend club like that, or a jongler specifically, why is it more about survival there than it would be at another weekend club that you still enjoy playing?
Well, back then, you know, they targeted Hindus, stag do's, office parties. So you'd have these big groups where maybe one person had the idea to go to comedy and everyone else was just dragged along. So you were constantly fighting to get attention. And then I found myself doing material that I would be embarrassed to do anywhere else other than there. Not embarrassed.
Do you mean in terms of like...
I was doing Hindu, stag do sort of jokes.
Dick jokes.
To get... No. I'm a big fan of dick jokes.
Okay.
And I think there's absolutely a place for dick jokes in everyone's set. I am not ashamed of dick jokes. I think dick jokes are fucking great. Especially if it's a decent... Sure, lazy dick jokes are bad, just like lazy jokes about cats and dogs are bad. But if you find a great angle on cats and dogs, then fucking go for it. If you find a great angle on dick gags,
Define then what kind of material was it that you were ashamed of?
I was doing things about... there was one specific bit that used to go really well of saying Hindus always have the tiny willies on their head, the Denny Bopper willies and stuff, but you never see a stag do walking around with little vaginas on their head, and that's because, you know, a willy, you can identify that straight away. A vagina, you know, a stag party's going to walk in and everyone's like, why have you got a kebab on your head? What are you... Do you know what I mean? And that's just... It's disgusting. But I did it in that... Whatever. And then my agent at the time, a fantastic man called Joe King.
Joe... Yeah. He was a lovely guy, Joe. I've not seen him in years.
He was lovely, and he was a comedy fan.
Yeah.
He used to drive me and Greg Davis to our gigs.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And Alan Cochran was with him as well. Cochran That's when I first met Joe. Yeah,
Mickey Flanagan was with him. Mm-hmm. Will Smith was with him.
Mm-hmm.
With him. Andrew Bird. You know, he had an eye.
Mm.
But he loved live comedy. And he retired because he got to a point where he realised... A couple of us were getting sort of TV stuff, and he didn't like dealing with that sort of thing, and realized he just realized he would be holding us back. He came along to a gig I did at Jonglers back in the time, and I don't know what their gigs like now because I don't play them, and there's fantastic comics who do play them, and I'm not against anyone playing anywhere. You know, as I said earlier, I'm up for anywhere where I can perform. It was just my personal choice. And I walked off stage and Joe said to me, "Did you enjoy that?" I went, yeah, kind of. And he went, "Are you happy with what you did there?" I was like, "Yeah, I got laughs." And he went, "Yeah, but are you happy with what you did?" And I went, "You know what these gigs are like, Joe. You know, you just got to get through them." And then he said, "Bring your product to the environment. Don't become a product of the environment."
That's nice.
And that's exactly what was happening.
Yes.
Yeah. So he said, "Let's make the decision. We'll cut your Jongleurs gigs down, shall we?" And I went, "Yep, okay, fine." And you know, Jongleurs gets a bad name, but they did great stuff for putting the word of comedy out there.
Mm-hmm.
But there was too much work. We all knew that. Do you know what I mean? There were times, you know, this was...
Weren't you, what are we talking? Can you put a year on this, roughly?
I am going to say, I got to the UK in 2000, and then I was only on the open mic circuit for about a year, quit my day job after about a year. So it was kind of the start of 2002 that I was just living off comedy. Mm. And there was heaps of work. Heaps, not just Jeff Whiting level thing, because that's the level I was at. And you know, I'll be eternally grateful to Jeff Whiting because he allowed me to quit my day job. Do you know what I mean?
Mirth Control fulfills that function for an awful
and
lot of people.
It's a great training ground. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you're playing god awful rooms, but you've got to play god awful rooms to become good at playing the good rooms. Do you know what I mean? And what a great place to learn. You know, doing Hollywell and Wales or something like that, you know, to 30 drunk Welsh people, you know, what a great way to learn, you know, because make your mistakes there. That's what you do.
Make your mistakes there and then drive the headliner home while he explains what mistakes you made.
Yeah.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, if you're lucky. Yeah, if you're lucky, you'll get that. If you're unlucky, the headliner will put on headphones and fall asleep.
Happened to me as well.
Yeah.
Let's talk about who that was after this.
So I think from 2002, and it was probably for longer, but from my experience, 2002 till roughly about 2012?
Mm-hmm.
When did Jongleurs go under? Was it 2011, 2012?
I don't know. Did they go under ever?
No, but all the, you know, their chain, the stuff. Yeah, their chain.
Sure, sure.
Unlinked.
Yes, when Highlight existed as well.
When it was just Jongleurs. And then from the ashes of Jongleurs rose the mighty phoenix of Highlight and Jongleurs.
Yes,
which are now back in bed together.
I believe so. I don't understand.
I think it was around about 2011. So for those years, 2002, 2011, there was so much work. There was too much work. So there were a lot of average comics who weren't needing to push themselves or anything like that. And I think it's healthy that the circuit's compacted because everyone's having to up their game now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Because everyone's having to hustle a bit harder for work. So that means it's getting to a point where you've got to be good. If you're good, you'll get work. That's bottom line. It's meritocracy on the circuit. If you're good, you'll get work. And I think the compaction of the circuit is healthy for the circuit in the long run. And it's heartbreaking because I know a lot of people who are really affected by it, and I've been affected by it, and it's been hard. But in the long run, I think it's probably going to be healthy because only the people whose hearts are in it are going to stick with it, aren't they? Do you think? Have I crossed a line?
No, not at all, not at all. I hear both sides of this argument. I don't know where I come down on it. I mean, if it keeps going like this, is that healthy in the long run?
Well, no, it can't keep compacting, but I think it's going to get...
Well, can't it?
Well, until it's just one club in the country.
Yeah, people aren't going to see comedy anymore, and it's all available on telly, and they don't risk their money.
In the UK, people like going out.
Or maybe they do like going out, but maybe the other thing happens, people keep starting to do stand-up comedy, and supply is far bigger than demand.
Yeah,
and maybe that doesn't have an effect whereby it sort of it strips down so only the strong survive.
Right.
Maybe it goes under.
Yeah, maybe it collapses under its own weight.
Yeah. I mean, that's, isn't that what happened in New York? That now everywhere's pay to play and, you know, you can only get money if you're a headliner and the money's dependent on how many people you can get in through the door, so only TV comics...
Is that the same with the clubs? I thought the clubs were still...
That is a potential... Yeah, sure, with Carolines, you know, you get like a... You, as I understand it, I've only been there once, but you get an MC, who is basically an opening act,
that
doesn't get paid very much, like, you know,
$20.
Brilliant. And then you get a middle act that gets $50, then you get Louis C.K. or whoever else, you know, someone who's bringing... You know, that could conceivably happen here. You know, if you do open spots, that's why they have all the bringer shows, don't they, in New York?
Yeah, I know.
You do an open spot, you're going to bring 15 people with you, two drink minimum, the rest of it. It is horrible. Okay. Yeah. And can you not see that happening here? People are, I believe, Sean Brightman's club, We Love Comedy, they've started doing a free comedy night. And it's not, and what they're doing for is, they're going for is a different angle, as I understand it, to simply, this is free, it might be shit. They're going, this is a really good comedy club, but we're going to do donations because that's the way to survive in the marketplace. And a lot of people on the, a lot of experienced comics on Facebook are going, this is bullshit, the whole thing's going to fall apart. I really don't know what, I don't know who's right.
I don't know who's right. I guess we're going to have to wait and see.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you know, how do you shore that up? I mean, I like what Jason Manford's attempting to do.
Yes.
I think that's a hugely honourable sort of thing, especially because he doesn't need to be doing it.
People haven't heard about this. This is, he started his own chain of comedy
Manfords.
Clubs. Yeah.
And they're comedy nights, aren't they? Yeah. They're not purpose-built clubs or anything.
No.
He's going into venues, he's making sure the venues are decent, that there's decent sound and lighting.
I believe he aspires to creating some sort of kite mark of quality.
Yeah.
So that, you know, so it does effectively what we're saying of going, the strong survive, you know.
Yeah,
The acts who are worth, you know.
Yeah. And I think he's got quite a few up and running already. So, you know, that's really good. I don't know. It's a bit depressing to think that it could all just shrink away.
You came in here very buoyed up and I said, oh, do you think it can survive? And I've driven it into the... I depressed you.
Yeah.
Let's get back.
I folded my arms and everything.
Yeah. Yeah, very well. You lasted 30 minutes and I've convinced you it's all going to
It's all going tits up. I don't think... But I remember when I first got over here, comics were saying, no, the bubble's going to pop. Bubbles pop, mate. Bubbles pop.
Were they really?
Yes.
Were they?
Yeah.
Okay. That's
and
good
I could
to hear.
Never.
That'll be good
I
to hear for all the
that.
People listening to this on their way to gigs for 20 and 30 quid who are hearing you go, oh, there was too much work back then. It'll be nice to hear.
No, but I mean, you know, when I said there's too much work, there was, you know, loads of gigs. I remember doing Plymouth for Jeff Whiting where I. My fee covered my train fare, and I got accommodation with it, and I did the gig, and the gig went really, really well, and the guy running it said to me, that was great, I want to give you a little bit of a bonus, which is unheard of.
Mm.
I was like, oh, awesome, and he slipped me £5, right? So I got.
Did he tuck it into your pants?
No, he palmed it to me. Nice. Like I was going to be getting like a 20 or 30 quid sort of. £5. And I remember going, oh, fucking £5. But then realised, oh, I can eat tonight.
Yeah, right.
Awesome. You know, and I remember going to bloody Hereford on the National Express and having enough to buy. No, I did. And then the next day I was going on to Liverpool and I was faced with a whole day in Liverpool. And I had no money. And I rung Steve Williams. And I said to him, I've got no money. What am I going to do? I mean, it's, you know, it was like 10 in the morning. And the gig wasn't until 8:30 at night. And then I was getting a ride home with one of the other comics. He said, have you got any money in your account? I said, I've got £1, £2. And he said, go into the supermarket. Because it was a Saturday, I think. Yeah, go into the supermarket and... buy loads of food to see you through and get cash back because it was back when you just signed for it and it wouldn't get processed till the Monday. So, and he said, because you're getting paid tonight and you'll be able to put the money in on Monday. And so that was how I survived, just going and doing that. And I think I bought, no, I know what I bought. I bought a massive packet of croissants. Just ate them all day.
Bear Grylls,
dry
top
croissants.
Survival tip.
Yeah. But So, you know, if you are on your way to do a £30 gig out there, I hope it goes well. But, you know, £30 is still £30, isn't it?
Were you ever concerned about this as a lifestyle when you were thinking about wanting to be a comedian when you were younger? No. Did it ever concern you? Did it attract? Were you attracted to it? Did you go, I'm going to have a sort of vagabond, roguish
thing? No, one of my main motivations was I didn't want to get up early in the morning to go to a job. And so, you know, I flew to the UK when I was 20 to do stand-up, because I did it here for 2 years. So I guess to finish the origin story.
Go on.
Nice. I had really good gigs to start off with. I think, I had really good gigs to start off with. I genuinely did.
Why?
I think naivety and enthusiasm was just really pushing me through a lot. And then I got really cocky, and it all came terribly crashing down, like horribly.
Like at a specific moment that it all went wrong?
Yeah, I was walking to do this open mic. I was doing a weekly open mic night, and I was just going every week doing this. And I got really super arrogant, because my first, I'd say easily first 6 or 7 gigs just went really well. And I just thought, well, this is easy.
Yeah.
And I can remember walking to this venue called The Green Room in Christchurch. And The Green Room is where loads of New Zealand comics started. Rhys Darby started there. Chris Brain started there. Grant Lobbin. Juzzy. Loads. There's loads who started in this venue. And it was run by two eccentric American women. One of them who was a stand-up herself, and the other one was just some, you know, trustafarian sort of, you know, just loads of money.
So these were all in New Zealand still. We're talking about early
gigs. Yeah.
You came a cropper. It stopped,
big time.
Stopped working.
Well, I was walking to the gig, and this such a vivid memory. I was walking across some grass that had a sign that said "Keep off the grass," and I thought, I'm going to talk about that. That's really funny.
Mm-hmm.
Keep off the grass sign, and I'm walking across the grass. What are they going to do? And I thought, I'm just going to riff on that. I'm just going to improvise on that.
Okay.
Because I'm that good.
Okay.
And, oh my God, it was really, really embarrassing. Friends had come along that night, and it was the first time they'd seen me.
Okay.
A drama tutor had come along. It was the first time he had seen me. Just stunk the room out. And, you know, it was almost in tears when I...
It's funny, I think of people who've done improv as being able to kind of get themselves out of any situation, because that's what watching improv is. Once, it's like, vroom, vroom, vroom.
Yeah, but once the stink's in the room, mate, you can't shake that off. You can't shake that off. You know, and I started going into... You know, I realised too late. Like, you know, the ship was sinking, and my material established stuff that was working was tiny teacups, so I was trying to bail out with that, but it was just too little too late. And it was horrible. And I remember walking off stage, walking through that audience, couldn't make eye contact with anyone, didn't speak to anyone, just went straight outside, got in my mum's car, drove home, and just was like, oh, I can't do this now. I can't do this. But then the next day was like, oh, no, it was because you thought you were good and you're not. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And then I coined a phrase for myself, the 3 C's of comedy.
Go on.
Don't get cocky with comedy. Don't get complacent with comedy. And don't care about comedy. Because at the end of the day, it's just some laughs. And when I say don't care, I mean don't care if you die on your ass in Portsmouth.
Sure.
It's not going to be the end of your career.
Did you manage to stick to those rules?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. That's quite a funny feat of mental strength. You've designed a kind of a path for yourself and then followed.
Because I realised that's why, but that didn't fix me. I struggled at gigs for like the following 2 or 3 months probably. And I was really having to go through that trial by fire of going, no, but I want that. I want to get what I had. I want that back.
Yes.
And that's what
pushed me. So what are the key differences between what you do now and what you were doing back then?
Well, back then it was Ben Norris who pointed this out. So I did the New Zealand Comedy Fest in 99, and I entered the Raw New Act competition, and I got through to the finals, and I smoked it in the heats, in the semis, just smoked it. And then in the finals, thought I had a really good gig, and but I came second. And this guy called Dodge won.
Okay.
Who, I don't know what he's doing now. But sure. He, what I remember of him was he was super, super relaxed on stage and, you know, was just tossing offhand jokes at people in the audience and just really, just super relaxed. Like, looked like he belonged up there. Whereas I did this big performance piece. I could do a backflip off a chair. So I thought, I've got to put that in my stand-up.
Oh, my
so
God.
So built a routine that finished with me doing a backflip off a chair, which most of the time people were like, wow! It wasn't funny. You know, maybe a little bit funny building up to it, but it was mainly just do a backflip off a chair. Anyway, so I come second, and I was devastated. And I spoke to Ben Norris afterwards, who was one of the judges.
Yeah.
And he said, it's like you're doing a monologue. It's like you could do that even if the audience wasn't there. And I said, well, yeah. And he went, this isn't acting. So you don't want that wall. So you need to interact with the audience. And so I took that information on board and then realised, yeah, I've been interacting with audiences my entire fucking life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I haven't been
then
using
why
that.
Don't I try using that thing I can do? As opposed to that backflip I can do.
Maybe yeah, that's exactly. What they want. And I tell you, the only time the backflip worked was when I almost smashed my face on the ground. Because I was standing on a rickety chair, and a chair just left from underneath me and almost smashed my face. And the whole place went really quiet. And then I just stood up and went, and then I spent 3 weeks in hospital.
Yeah.
And they went ballistic.
Yeah, okay.
And a friend of mine was at that gig, and I saw her in Wellington last week, and she still talks about that. Because she'd seen me doing the backflip normally.
Yeah.
And she said, that was so hilarious. And that's when I started realising, it's not about showing off. It's not about, it's comedy, you know. You've got to always undermine anything that, if you can do a backflip on stage, fuck it up, because that's funnier.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's a hell of a bumper sticker. Yeah. That's good. That's a lovely idea. So, do you have any pretensions to anything other than just making them laugh? And I don't mean the word pretensions in a negative
way. I know exactly what you mean. And this is why I think I'm in a bit of a state of flux at the moment, is because I want to have a bit more meaning to what I say. But ultimately, I'm playing comedy clubs, mate. You know, not interesting clubs. You don't get paid to play interesting clubs.
Yeah, it's not interest business, is it? Doesn't work.
Yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah, and this is why, this is where I come and get really pissed off with in Edinburgh and stuff like that, is shows get reviewed saying, yes, it was funny, but I didn't learn it. I struggle with that, going, what? But if you're going to see a comic, why do you need to? Like, you watch Louis C.K. for an hour, you don't come away knowing a huge amount about him, but you know you've just fucking laughed all the way through, right?
Yeah.
He does reveal a lot about himself.
Well, he does, doesn't he?
But he doesn't have an overriding fucking story arc or theme, and he doesn't fucking cry at the end. Do you know what I mean? It's just wall-to-wall funny, you know?
But do you think when you do your stuff that it's wall-to-wall funny, or as close as... I mean, obviously, you're very funny.
As much as I want.
There's a whole shitload of jokes in there.
Yeah, as much as I can get in there, yeah.
Sure. So... And you feel like that isn't enough for the critics, that isn't enough for the critical reception of the show. You feel like there's something
else. Sometimes
it's not. There's something else that they want.
Yeah, but then in saying that, you should always just do what you do.
Mm.
And you know, whatever happens will happen. You shouldn't, it's that whole don't become a product of the environment. You know, as soon as you go, 2007, I took a show up to Edinburgh that I tried to have a deep and meaningful moment.
What was that? What was
it? It was the Hero Show.
Okay.
Tried to have it. I did tell a story that meant a lot to me, but, you know, I put it in there for a deeper meaning. Do you know what I mean? And I had this whole fucking story arc going through, and I had a horrible time. And it was because that's not what I do. It's not what I do.
So did you get the reviews? Did it work? Did anyone come away going,
no, I got like,
hey, turns out Jerry Christmas is actually deep and meaningful?
No, of course not. You know, I got a spate of sort of 3-star sort of reviews, but no one mentioned the heartfelt sort of bit. You know, and then I started feeling trapped in it. And, you know, certainly near the end of the month, as I was coming up to that bit in the show, I was like, oh, here we fucking go. Do you know what I mean? And instead of just dropping it, I just had this perception that, no, because this is what I said in my publicity, this is what I have to stick to this. And you don't, man. You absolutely don't. And it's taken me too long to realise that. And now I treat my hours like, you know, the vibe I give out when I'm comparing. Do you know what I mean? Just relaxed and loose, and whatever comes up, fucking comes up. This year, the show's a bit more, not structured, but it is. Last year, I was really loose. I was doing a Q&A thing, which a lot of people have done, but I was doing it as an exercise to prove, to train myself and to improvise into material. So yes. I'd get the audience to ask me questions.
Yes.
But that's hard on the audience. If you just go, ask me a question, you know, it's too fucking, it's too big, and they're not expecting that.
And how many times have you seen someone say, ask me a question? So when I ask them a question, they've got nothing on it.
And exactly. Like, yeah, yeah. And so I didn't want to do that. And quite often that's a bit of a stock line anyway. Any
yeah.
questions?
Yeah, sure.
Get to laugh.
Yeah.
Move on. Whereas I like, no, seriously. Any fucking questions, anything, and I'll deal with it. So what I started doing was I would banter with someone in the front row, ask them 3 questions, and roll with whatever they say, and then I would go, look, I've asked you 3
okay,
questions.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Here's your chance for revenge. Ask me a question. And that was just an easier way to relax them into doing the Q&A sort of thing.
And what sort of size rooms are we talking? What kind of capacity rooms are you playing at festivals?
Yeah, like 200-seater sort of things.
Okay.
And, you know, and
some selling, nights, just coming back to where we started this conversation, yeah. selling them well.
Yeah, last year sold them really well.
Great.
Really well. You know, I had a couple of nights that were low, but, you know, my sort of Thursday, Friday, Saturdays were sold out. But then maybe my Tuesday, Wednesdays. Tuesday, for some reason, always does well because I think it's the opening night down here. But it's that fucking Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
The grinder. But anyway, so I knew that whatever question came to me, I could, if I couldn't improvise something funny, and what I would do is if I improvised something and got a laugh, I'd move on. I wouldn't linger on it.
Yeah, okay.
Do you know what I mean? Get it. I mean, I'd finish it. I'd finish the thought, but if it got a laugh, I would just move on because that's where it falls down. Do you know what I mean? You get that laugh, and then you're improvising and hunting for that second laugh, and that might not come.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if I couldn't improvise something on it, I could definitely improvise my way into established material that I could relate to that. Do you know what I mean? And so yes. that was my exercise.
Okay, well, let's talk about funny then. What is it that, what do you think makes funny? What is it, what are the things when you're improvising or when you're writing a story, and do you actually, with your stories, do they grow? I sort of assume with you that they grow in the retelling. Do you ever
yes,
sit down?
Yes, they grow in the retelling. I sit down and write them.
Once they exist.
Once they exist, yeah.
Yeah, gotcha.
I sit down and I write them to try and find other bit, you know, something else that can tumble off sure. from an idea. Because I want to tell, my whole thing is stories peppered with jokes.
Yeah.
And like the ultimate person of that is Tommy Tiernan. And he was, I supported him a couple of years back, and that was a fucking education, and it was amazing. And he is by far my favorite comic by a long shot, you know. And I didn't really know of Tommy Tiernan that much, but yeah, of course I knew of him, but I hadn't really seen him until a couple of years back, and was like, holy shit, that's amazing. And then supporting him, and so. Yeah, it's, and his stories are just fucking chocker with jokes, but they're not even jokes, are they? They're just his way. Do you know what I mean? And so that's what my goal has been, is storytelling, but loaded with jokes within the story.
Sure.
And try not to let the jokes be the detriment of the story. If
yes,
you know what I mean?
Yes.
And when I say stories, you know, I'm talking like a 3-4 minute thing. I'm not out there spinning a yarn for 20 minutes. Mm, mm. Yeah.
So, but what is it that's, funny? When, what is it, what's the thing when you go, hang on, I've got something here?
Yeah.
What do you use to find more in it? What's the, if you're a moth, what is that flame that you're going round? Do you know what I mean? When we're all trying to get closer to that thing. I know I'm asking an impossible question.
It is. I just never give up on it. I just keep trying to find other things to add to it. Do you know what I mean? And if it doesn't work, just don't do it the next night. Do you know what I mean? And if it kind of works, then keep sort of, do you know what I mean? Never, I can't, it's, so if I've got a joke that's funny, I'll just stick with that for a while, and then I'll start going, oh, let's see if you can do that joke, and then see if you can just do a bit of improv after it. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And see if that can go anywhere. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. Because by doing that, suddenly you've now got a 5-minute routine as opposed to something that initially just started as a 1.5-minute bit. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And suddenly finding, oh shit, I can link that into that thought that I've never found a way to do.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, okay.
And also the whole thing of stringing lesser jokes into one bit. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And their cumulative value creates, do you know, like we've all got like one stray little fucking joke that is okay. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, well, he doesn't work by himself. But you lump him in with 3 or 4 other ones of his level, the cumulative effect is, do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
And the thing about improving bits is you've got to try not to recreate the moment that happened the night before. Do you know what I mean? That's what I've
thought. Yes, yes, absolutely, yeah. Because I mean, you see a lot of people, that fake mistake thing.
Yeah, the fake mistake thing's fine because, you know, that can be a little joke in itself, and if you improvise a joke, but I'm talking about like little beats, little moments that last night it just came out.
Yes.
And then the next night, you're going, oh yeah, remember to try and create that moment again. And you can't create that moment again. So you've got to let that fucking, let it go. Go somewhere else.
You were saying before that you're in the middle of a sort of a change at the moment towards trying to get more meaning into your work.
More meaning, but yeah. Yeah, because since becoming a dad, a lot of things are starting to make me really fucking angry about the future that we're laying down. And I'm becoming politically aware of shit, but I'm not intelligent enough to form a concise argument. All I've got is Putin's a dick, mm-hmm. and I feel strongly about that, mm-hmm. but I'm not at a point mentally that I can extrapolate that into a point of view that is interesting to people. Instead of a point of view that everyone's like, yeah, we all share that, mate. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? You're not giving us any insight. So I'm battling with a bit of frustration about that. Because I can, you know, and also, if I can keep it funny, you know? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I don't think I've ever really been insightful. And that is something that I wouldn't mind being. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't mind fucking people to walk away going, that was really funny. And then having a discussion about something that I...
Do you... It's interesting, man. I know exactly what you mean.
But then maybe I'm just clutching it at something that will never happen, and that's fine. As long as everything keeps being funny. Because I think that's the... And I fucking love being funny. You know, getting... Having an audience fucking laughing and stuff, it's just such a... It's an awesome high. And, you know, if you get a small room to fucking laugh, you know, if you're doing your show to 10 people and they're laughing, then you're going to have fucking no dramas with 100 people. You know, it's just going to be... And it's when you can't play... When you can play 100, but you can't play 10. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And when you play 10, that's when you're... That's when a harsh spotlight is put on your material, you know, because that's when you're like, oh, is that actually funny? Because they're smiling.
I want to just stay on the meaning thing for a minute, which is a unit of time.
I know that.
You don't spend a lot of time cudgelling your brains trying to write clever stuff. You get up there, you do what you're good at, you live it.
It's the gap thing.
Yeah.
It's a gap. I know I'm a gap comic. I've written a couple of scripts and stuff. I did a online series and wrote that, and that was a real challenge for me because I've never believed that I can do that.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? I've never believed that on paper I'm funny. Do you know what I mean? I've always thought
You felt like it's all very well being Mr. Saturday Night.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, how do you turn it into something?
Yeah, can I be funny on paper?
And could you?
I think it's pretty funny. And people who have watched it have been really positive. And, you know, now I'm starting to take more writing opportunities because I think with the circuit compacting as it is, you know, the internet is a great way for comics to go because it's really suited to how we've done things. You know, when you're an open micer, you create your own content and you're not getting paid for it. So when you're starting something up on the internet,
Sure. You're
creating your own content and you're not getting paid for it. So we know that process. Chuck shit out on YouTube, whatever medium you can find. And it doesn't have to be you fucking doing stand-up, does it? You know, funny's funny. Put it in another context or something like that.
I totally agree with you. Whenever
and it's not that easy.
I have a huge amount of fear because I'm like, I've been a live guy for 20 years.
Mm.
So what do I know about the unblinking eye of a camera? You know, I feel like I'm from a similar position to you. I'm a live role with the audience kind of guy. So I find that very frightening to kind of go, oh, this thing, all those road miles we did, that's not so important now.
I think it is because it still made you who you are and it's still giving you the angles you're taking when you're performing and the choices that you're making. You know, doing comedies where there's no audience, do you know what I mean? And you've just got to be kind of relying on whatever innate ability and internal sense you've got. Sure, the people you're working with can be laughing and stuff, but there's always part of you thinking, yeah, but is that because we're involved in it? Do you know what I mean? Is this going to be... you know, and I've done studio sitcoms, and studio sitcoms are... In 2009, I did a show called Persuasionists.
I did the warm-up for several of those episodes.
That's right.
Some alone and some with Mr. Richard Sandling.
That was weird that you did it together. But I found that a... Because I'd done loads of warm-up. I'd done acting. I'd done stand-up. And I felt... studio sitcom were all of those skills meeting. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, because it's acting, but there's a live audience that you respond to and you...
I would interact with them in between scenes.
Yes, I remember.
Because my theory on it was, if I can get them liking me before I say any of this dialogue...
Totally.
Then they'll be with me.
Chucking in some cheeky swears before a panel game record.
Yeah, of course. All that stuff. And I did, I just did another sitcom. Oh, the reason why I had to cancel our original one of these, Up the Woman, which is Jessica Hines.
Yes. Okay.
Very, very good. Very, very good. And that was a great experience, you know, because you've got, you know, Jessica and the writers really good. And then you're working with like top notch actors and then... the guy I was working with is a very good actor, and he jokingly was kind of going, "You're one of the most unprofessional people," because I need to be able to play before going into that sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? So I'll be dicking around. I'll be making sure that I'm not disrupting anything, but you know, like the sound guy's standing there with holding the boom up like that, and I'll just. Sort of, because I need to relax before going into it. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to go intense. So the way I can relax is by dicking around with someone. And I did new tricks, and I didn't know anyone.
Yeah.
And was feeling very tense, and I suddenly realized, oh, I've got to dick around with someone here.
Yeah.
And the best people to dick around are the crew. They're, you know, because they're fucking, they're doing their job, but They need to break up the fucking... That's what I think, anyway. They probably just get annoyed by me. But the...
Oh, you're cockhead, Jared.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the sound guy's standing there with his boom, and I just sort of walked up and stood in front of him and went, can I get in for some of that? Yeah, for a hug there? That's what you're wanting, isn't it? You know what I mean? He's like, oh, fuck off, mate, fuck off. You know, and then you just give him a hug. He's like, fucking hell, who's this guy? Do you know what I mean? And then you're in.
That
allowed me then to take that relaxed sort of banter onto set.
Absolutely.
And that's how I've realised I have to work. I can't just, because I'll be too tense going in, you know? Do you know what I mean?
Are you
going
to do lots more acting stuff?
I hope so. I hope so. Because I really enjoy it. And that's been my sort of goal is just, you know, if I'm not going to immediately say no to opportunities. You know, I want to have a look at it. And if I think it's going to be fun, then I'm going to go for it. I kind of had an internal battle with when I got offered the Panto in 2012.
Okay, which Panto did you do?
Snow White and Seven Dwarfs.
No, at, which whereabouts?
Oh, New Wimbledon Theatre.
Okay.
And it was a...
I remember seeing... Was your face on billboards and stuff?
It was everywhere, mate. Yeah. I couldn't go to my local train station because...
Yeah.
It was all over.
Yeah. I remember seeing that and thinking, that is a fascinating choice. Well, I mean, presumably there was a truck full of money and you were near your babies.
Yes, there was that. You know, it was 6 weeks down the road from my house.
God, why would
you not? Truckload of money. I've never done a panto before. And, you know, when they offered it to me, I said to my wife, oh, I'm going to turn it down. I'm not doing panto. And she said, are you kidding me? There's nothing wrong with doing panto. She said, and then she said, I saw Spike Milligan in a panto when I was a kid. I was like, really? She went, yeah. And so I was kind of like, oh, yeah, fuck it. All right, I'll give it a go. And, you know, I said, as long as I get to put my own mark on the script of what I say, that I'm up for it. And they were up for it. So
I wanted to see that. I'm sorry, I've got no idea. Did you enjoy it?
Mate, it was an insane amount of fun. It was insane. You know, that helped a lot that the cast were fantastic and the backstage crew were awesome. Trigvi was... working backstage.
That's no way.
That's where I met him.
Oh, wow.
So we'd just stand in the wings having a fucking laugh. And then you take that on stage. Do you know what I mean? You take that good time vibe on stage. But, you know, so I was the henchman. And I set myself a target. We were doing two shows a day for 6 weeks. And I didn't want to get bored. So I set myself a challenge of every time the Queen called me on stage, I'd have to improvise a response to it. And she would call me on stage 5 times in each show.
Okay.
Gotcha. So I'm trying to come up with 10 things a day.
Mm-hmm.
And all on a theme of, you know, she's the Wicked Queen, so she's got to be, you called my Queen of something bad. You know, like, you called my Queen of warm lager. You called my Queen of train delays. You know, whatever was happening in Wimbledon, like, one day there was roadworks, you know, and it was all down to one lane, so you called my Queen of Roadworks, you know, it was shit like that. And I mean, wasn't anything amazing, every now and then it was, but it just meant that I couldn't phone it in. And that's my biggest fear, is being on stage phoning it in.
Were you saying earlier on that you are doing lots of different things, but you're concerned that means you're spreading yourself too thin in terms of generating a touring audience as a stand-up?
Yeah, I think it's... I think sitcom, like when you're acting, I don't know if that directly brings people to your stand-up. Sure. Because I think there's a bit of a separation.
Yeah, you need to
there.
Get... If it's exactly the right thing, if it's Izzy Sutty in Peep Show...
Yeah.
You're brilliant stand-up, you do a part in which you're brilliant at being a version of yourself, and then people go, you know, you bill yourself as Izzy Sutty, Dobby from Peep Show. And people go, oh, that's that great comedy person.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very difficult to achieve.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, like, I look at Lee Mack, I think Lee Mack's superb, and Not Going Out's great. And isn't it one of the most successful fucking sitcoms?
Yeah.
Or something, you know, it's huge. And I just kind of go, why is he not fucking doing 10 nights at the O2? Because he's got millions of people watching his show. But that's where I start to think maybe there's a disconnect between they see Lee Mack.
He's touring, isn't he?
Oh, of course, yeah, and he's fucking successful.
Sure.
You know, and he probably doesn't want to play arenas. He's probably keeping it real.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I just wonder if there's a disconnect between, do you know what I mean? Like, we all know stand-ups who have been in movies and stuff like that, but don't pull a huge crowd.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. Someone like Smiley.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, brilliant, brilliant actor.
Oh,
brilliant.
And an incredible stand-up.
Yeah, a really great stand-up.
I did work with him in Northern Ireland, and shit, that guy can weave something out of nothing. He really can, and he's a raconteur.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's what I want. That's what I want to be, as a raconteur. You know, just be able to just fucking stand there and you've got a story on something, story on something. Nick Wilty is like that.
Yes, yes, yes. Know? So are you, what is the plan? Is the plan to go, right, I'm going to just focus on the stand-up stuff?
Yeah.
Or is the plan to, I'm going to keep focusing on the stand-up stuff, but you've got so many fingers in so many pies. It's like, yeah, there's acting and, you know, yeah, you're busy with lots of things.
Yeah.
Is that a problem? Is that a challenge? Is there one that you've got to stick to more than the others?
I have to stick to stand-up more than the others because that's my bread and butter and that's what I'm loving doing. But I'm going to take acting opportunities as they come, and I'm really starting to focus also on writing and trying to get stuff away. So
has having kids made you more focused on that stuff?
Yeah, especially when, you know, in the area I live in, there's no decent high school, so we're kind of going, we love this area. We want to stay in this area, but we don't want them to go to a shit high school. So does that mean private school? So that means, you know, 15 grand a year. Where the fuck is that money going to come from? Do you know what I mean? So it's like, okay, it's time to start challenging yourself in other areas and trying to work hard at other things that can... Because the problem with stand-up is you have... To earn money from it, you have to fucking be there. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're getting a DVD out there that's selling loads and loads, but that's not really happening anymore, is it? You know, if you go on tour, you have to fucking be there. That's the only problem with stand-up. So if you can write something that can go off and generate money while you're in Newcastle, then isn't that great? And as long as it's creative...
Funny is whenever I think along these lines, I think, oh, I'm such an idiot. I'm such a short-sighted idiot.
No.
I mean, to get out there and do the and have the glory when I could have been focusing on writing a radio show or something.
No. I've gone through all that thinking, mate. I've gone through all that thinking, and you'll do it when the time is right for you. That's what I've... Because I look back on all the time that I just probably... You know, I lost all of 2005 to a computer game. Oblivion, fucking brilliant. But I look back on that and think, if I didn't play Oblivion, I would have gone to Edinburgh in 2005. There was other reasons, and that's just a stupid one. But I always look back, but then if I'd gone in 2005, my show wouldn't have been as good as what it was in 2006. Because I was ready in 2006.
Mm.
I didn't know I was. The whole time leading up to it, I was going, But... I think mentally, when you start doing things, it's never too late and it's always the perfect time is when you actually start doing it. And you should never look back going, oh, I wish I'd started this ages ago.
How because do you know I what? Cultivate if
you,
that?
If you did do that ages ago, it was probably going to be shit, mate. So
yeah, it's a lovely way to think. How can my listeners, ultimately is what I mean, I cultivate that? You know, that mentality, or you know, you miss an opportunity. It's like, oh, well, it was never meant to happen, that sort of thing. You're like the opposite of that. How do you, you know... it's great, man. You're so talented, you're so happy, you're so successful, and you're applying yourself to the next load of hard work, going, right, going to go and smash this. Very inspiring.
I think you have to, because if you don't... I had a very fucking tough year last year, and for part of 2012, just career-wise and frustration-wise. And... You know, went through some very horrible financial things that I won't go into, of course. But
Can you give us a little bit more than a tough year? I'm not asking you to talk about
I'll absolutely give you loads of things fell through last year. Okay, loads of things that I had done, I think a very typical thing of comedians, of, you know, there's work in the diary and you spend the money before you get it.
Gotcha.
And so essentially I renovated my house, which needed to be done, based on work that was going to come in and then fell through.
Gotcha,
okay. Like massive, like it was a fucking punch in the gut after a punch in the gut after a punch in the gut. And if I didn't have my family, I don't know what the fuck would have happened. I was in a very, very bad place mentally at the start of last year. I was getting really bitter, really frustrated and angry.
About stand-up.
About stand-up. And I started doing the thing that is the worst thing you can fucking do, which is looking at other people. Going,
I was going to guess that.
Why the fuck are they? And it was a horrible, horrible place to be in. And then I came down to New Zealand and I had all of that fucking anger and baggage with me. But I had 10-day holiday at my parents' place in Australia in the middle of fucking nowhere. And I didn't think about comedy for those 10 days. Do you know what I mean? And things started to get into perspective. And then suddenly when I hit New Zealand, it was a fucking... It was like I had a... Do you know, I was resuscitated, I guess. And I really... It was hard, man. It was hard to mentally focus on positives instead of negatives. And the way I've tried to do that is by not counting... By not focusing on what I term as big victories, but focusing on small victories and being happy with them. Because if you judge your life on the big moments being the best moments, then the rest of your life is going to be fucking depressing. But if you concentrate on the small victories all the way through, then your life's fucking great, man. Do you know what I mean? That it's not like an airy-fairy sort of... Do you know what I mean? It's like last night you said... was it last night or the night before? You said... I did a show to 15 people, but it's the best show I've done.
Yeah.
It's those things that you cling to and you hold on to, and then the cumulative effect of them, as well as keeping that positive outlook. Because everyone suffers. Everyone fucking suffers if you go bitter and twisted. We know comics who are like it. We know civilians who are like it. And it affects everyone around them, and it affects them, and it affects what you do. And I think that is fucking hell. You don't want to go there. And if you do, you want to drag yourself out of there. Because I was there for maybe 3 months, and I know people have gone through... Everything's relative to what you've been through. But for me, that was the hardest 3 months, comedy-wise, I've ever... Because suddenly I had to give a shit about how I'm going to look after my family and all that sort of thing. And that's a huge burden for someone who's essentially just dicking around. Do you know what I mean? So, and then it was just, I've got to, I don't know where it's going, but it...
Go on.
I just had to drag myself out of that place, because otherwise I was just going to keep spiraling and spiraling, and I would stop being who I am, essentially, because I was giving in. And... I think in this career that we've all chosen, because there's something about it that we fucking love, but there's something else about it, and that's adversity, and you're always banging your head against it, always fighting against it, but that makes you stronger. Do you know what I mean? Because if it was all just given to you, you'd be fucking lazy. Do you know what I mean? We've got all our own mountains to climb, and you just can't give up on climbing, and we might be climbing our entire lives. And you might climb and get to the peak and fucking hate it there. Do you know what I mean? So you've just got to... So once you get to that peak, you've got to find another peak to climb. And that's like what Eddie Izzard does. Do you know what I mean? So fuck you. Why the fuck are you trying to do stand-up in Russian, mate? You know? You've nailed it in English. And it's like, yeah, well, yeah, because I've done that. Now I need another peak to climb. And I think I've realised I'm the type of person that if I stop climbing, I start plummeting. And that's why I'll continue striving at stand-up, but I'm going to start trying to strive at other aspects of performance, you know, and see where it takes me. You know, I would be more than happy to fucking write something that gets away, and I'm not in it, but I'm involved in the creative process. That'll be really frustrating. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to, what the fuck? But if it's the difference between it getting made and it not getting made, then I'll go for it getting fucking made. Do you know what I mean? As long as I'm involved creatively with it. So, in a sense, what I'm saying is, it's a fucking quote from some philosopher, I think Homer, to strive, to seek, to find, and never to yield. And that quote, I fucking etched it in the back of my diary when I was working in a fucking call centre. Do you know what I mean? And every time I just go, I don't want to be doing this, I'd flick that open and just fucking stare at it. And, you know, going, yeah, I'll do 8 hours of this shit, and then I'm going to go to the fucking, what was that, the Camden Head, and do 5 minutes after 10 people have also done 5 minutes, and that's going to be the best part of my fucking day. As soon as I step into that environment, there's people I like, people on the same wavelength as me, and then I'm going to do 5 minutes, and that's the best part of my fucking day.
That'll do us. Thank you, mate. That's great.
So thanks to Jared for that. To strive, to seek, to find, and never to yield. Very inspiring. Do me a favour and tweet me your favourite inspirational slogans at ComComPod. Let me know what phrases you use to get yourself out of bed and down the mine pit. Coalface, cafe, gym, I don't know. Let me know. Let's share a few of those. Jared is, of course, at this year's Edinburgh Festival. I'm going to go and write my long list now on the coach on the way back from Bristol to London of all the stuff I want to see. Jared mentioned Trigvy there. Trigvy Wakenshaw, that is. His Edinburgh show, Kraken, is going to blow everyone's heads off this year. So get in quick. Help make it a huge year for Trigvy. He absolutely deserves it. Everyone is going to be talking about that show. So get in at the ground floor. Go and see Trigvy Wakenshaw's show, Kraken. And, of course, my show, Extra Life, at the Pleasance Attic at 7 p.m. every night in the courtyard. And, of course, Jared's show. So go and see all of that stuff. But remember, if you didn't hear it anywhere else, you heard it here first. Trigvy, I saw him do 15 minutes in New Zealand. Blew me away. This episode was co-produced by Nathan Wood. And next week we have Adrienne Truscott, a blinding episode. I'm really looking forward to that. That's all for now. I've been Stuart Goldsmith. I'll speak to you very soon. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.